The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. The Middle East is now the world's most militarized region. The Middle East, right around Jerusalem, Israel, the Arab countries surrounding the nation of Israel, have a total of enough tanks to just about represent the total force of the NATO forces of Europe. They have just about enough operational jet aircraft to represent the same number of tactical jet aircraft within the NATO forces of Europe. A tremendous report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, called SIPRI, which was even given to Congress by President Gerald Ford recently, it has been much talked of in the news, reveals that the world spent a staggering $280 billion on arms in 1975, and of course, the United States remains the chief arms supplier for nations around the world. But proportionate to the size of the area involved, the Middle East is now the most militarized area on the globe. Arms expenditures are running at a fantastic percent of the combined gross national product of those countries, whereas the average person in the Warsaw Pact nations or in NATO or here in the United States would have about 6% of his per capita earnings skimmed off for arms expenditures. In that region of the world, it runs at about 16% on a per capita basis. That's what the nations are spending of their combined gross national product on arms. The average per capita income there is about $845 a year. And the average per capita expenditure was about $135. There are now an estimated 2,300 operational jet combat aircraft in that region between the Arabs and Israelis, with about 10,500 tanks. And that compares to about 3,000 jets in the NATO forces and about 12,250 tanks for the NATO forces. So the arms buildup in the Middle East, according to that report, shows every sign of becoming completely out of control. And they're saying that unless the suppliers, that is primarily the Soviet Union and the United States, France, and some others, are willing to reduce the supply of arms, that there is an arms race underway in the Middle East, and they look upon it as an absolute tinderbox. Now, as if this is not enough, the dangerous trends in world arms, as underlined by President Ford's message to Congress recently, shows that within the next very few years, up to 40 countries could possess the atomic bomb. It is being urged by one government agency that the United States become the chief supplier of various fuels for atomic power reactors, instead of having some enriched uranium exported to these countries and having them provide their own fuel so they, in fact, produce their own plutonium and therefore have the wherewithal to make an atomic bomb. The idea would be to fight exports of enriched uranium to India and other nations. And an organization called the Atomic Industrial Forum claims that the United States and other nuclear powers ought to sell fuel and atomic waste reprocessing services to countries wanting to build atomic power reactors, and claim that such a policy might reduce the need for other nations to develop their own uranium enrichment and fuel processing plants, which of course could be used to produce nuclear weapons. And in that way, they felt that the United States could impose safeguards to prevent American-supplied reactors' fuel from being used in weapons. But it doesn't really matter if the United States cuts down their fuels, because at least five other countries are exporting them, including West Germany, France, Canada, Japan, and Sweden. As Gerald Ford said, and it's rather chilling to think that the amount of time necessary for building nuclear weapons out of these many, many nuclear reactors humming away in countries all over the world has been shrunk now down to a matter of weeks, if not, as Gerald Ford said, a few days. 40 countries, think of that, by 1985, might have enough plutonium to make a few bombs apiece. 30 countries, maybe, by 1980, just a few years from now. A few years ago, when I first was announcing the possibility that 40 nations may finally join what is called the Atomic Club, I was asking people to speculate on what kind of a world it would be when nations such as India and Pakistan, India and Bangladesh, the Israelis and various Arab countries, Syria and Egypt, perhaps Saudi Arabia. Cuba itself, other countries, especially in Africa, some of the major countries of South America, not only with enemies on that same continent, but principally the giant or the colossus to the north of the United States. In short, hostile, intransigent enemies in many parts of the world possessed nuclear weapons. You may or may not have heard the many programs I did during and after the Yom Kippur War. Back during the Nixon administration, when we were plunged into what became the energy crisis. The energy crisis was already upon us, but that certainly foreshortened the waiting period of time because of the Arab oil embargo. So suddenly we looked around and decided, with amazement, that we were dependent upon Arabs to supply us with our oil. But do you know why they cut off the oil? Well, maybe you remember, maybe not. They did so because of the United States' unconditional guarantee of the supplying of conventional weapons to the Israelis in that war. Some of the European countries came in for scathing rebukes and their share of the oil embargo from the collective efforts of the OPEC producers, principally in the Middle Eastern Gulf areas, and the cutoff of oil to West Germany, to Holland, and etc., because not of any monetary policies, not of low prices, not of irritation politically or in any other way, but because of the transshipment of American military supplies from forward area NATO bases on the soil of those countries. When tanks, mortars, machine guns, bombs, bullets, the jet aircraft themselves were transshipped from forward NATO areas because they were more instantly available there, and the Arab countries learned of it, then the countries which allowed those refueling stops in the case of some American C-130s and other aircraft, or the transshipment of military supplies from nations such as West Germany, when they learned of it, they also shared in the oil embargo. I privately mentioned then that I had every reason to believe the Israelis possessed the atomic bomb, and that our State Department understood that the Israelis would, if they were driven to the wall, use those atomic weapons on Cairo and other Middle Eastern capitals. In the wake of what happened in Uganda, and a book which was very quickly gotten off the press, it is out right now, about that unbelievable escapade of the rescue of those people who were aboard that hijacked Air France Airbus down in Entebbe. It has been practically admitted, as it was earlier, some months before, and I reported on this program, that the Israelis did in fact have a low yield, maybe in the kiloton range, nuclear bomb or two or more, which they would have used before they would have been overwhelmed by the Arab forces. Now, I don't know whether or not we begin to get the picture of precisely where we are in this world. It's difficult to get a handle on world conditions, let alone to really understand the overview of where they are taking us, of where we are going, of what this world is going to be like in another 5, 10, 15 years from now. As a matter of fact, people begin to wonder whether or not we're even going to be alive at that point in time, simply because of the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the ever-growing potential for those nuclear weapons to find their way into the hands of anarchists. People are beginning to wonder about the hijacking of nuclear fuels or nuclear weapons, or what about the possibility of a nuclear submarine with its skipper going insane? I mean, there are studies now. As we proliferate the number of nuclear weapons, there are studies wondering about the possibility of some of these weapons finding their way into the hands of various terrorist organizations. Those that are behind the sensational assassinations, kidnappings, skyjackings, and the like, as well as attacks upon Israeli citizens abroad, and in many countries, as far as that's concerned. Central and South America, an absolute hotbed of that same type of thing. So when you realize that we live in a world of the potential of up to 40 nations, many of them absolute intractable enemies, side by side, possessing nuclear weapons, you begin to wonder how long can we expect to avoid the outbreak of a nuclear bomb World War III? And would the big powers even unwillingly be drawn into such a confrontation? Well, it all revolves around the Middle East, believe it or not. The Middle East is the land of Bible prophecy. The Middle East is the land of Jesus Christ of Nazareth.
It is that focal point of Bible prophecy Jesus talks about in the most important prophecy in all the Bible in Matthew 24, when his disciples wanted to know, right in the streets of Jerusalem, right by the temple, what would be the sign of his coming and the end of an age. Not the end of the world, because the Bible does not talk about the end of the world in this time of which we speak. It doesn't speak of the destruction of all of humanity. It talks rather of a transitional age. It does talk about a nuclear war. It talks about a war in which so many vast percentages of populations would perish. It could only be speaking of nuclear weapons. But when Jesus talked first about great deception, then wars and rumors of wars, he was underlining and underscoring the very headlines you read in your newspapers and news magazines today. Look at what you've seen occurring in world news in the last very few weeks. One of the most massive earthquakes in all of human history has struck in China. Maybe they will never know exactly how many people have perished. It could be up toward 1 billion human lives. Here is this prophecy in Matthew 24 that talks about a time when, except the days would be cut short by supernatural intervention, all humanity could eventually be destroyed. And Jesus said in his own words that it would not only be as a result of political and military action, but there would come other natural, so-called, disasters. That there would be not only wars and rumors of wars, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, the world divided up into various power blocks, various antagonistic enemies, various neighbors warring one with the other, finally climaxing in a world war. But he said there would also be famines, and we are seeing famine gripping much of the world today, drought striking deeply into the western United States and Canada, and for that matter, all of Europe. Unprecedented, record-breaking weather in Britain and Europe, great crop loss in the Soviet Union, and there's going to be crop loss in the United States and in the nation of Canada, and that's going to drive prices up, and that's going to further fuel inflation, that's going to further fuel a lot of problems. So famine is with us, and I've announced many times in this broadcast our brand new booklet that is very, very hot off the press, called Famine, the Black Horse of the Book of Revelation, that mysterious sixth chapter of Revelation where you see those seals of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as they are called, where wraith-like specters of death and disease and destruction seem to be riding across the skies in a vision of John. And we have a booklet on this series of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the Black Horse, Famine. If you request a booklet on famine, you will get the shock of your life to see how widespread famine is in this world today. How the entirety of the living humanity is in the shadow of worldwide famine. How not only in the third world, the sub-Sahara, of Pakistan, India, some of those nations traditionally dependent upon the monsoon, famines of the past, but also famines today in isolated areas of the world where you wouldn't expect to find malnutrition taking such a toll of human life. You'll see the ever-widening hunger gap, the number of people on this earth, its fantastic population, about to double again by the turn of the century and double again in another 35 years, and whether or not foodstuffs and the manufacturing of foodstuffs, either artificially or, of course, the production through agriculture, can keep up with the high cost of feeding the poor. You'll see the ever-growing juggernaut of population and how the growth potential for the future is absolutely staggering. It is statistically documented, but it also shows you what Bible prophecy says about it. And it shows that weather patterns are shifting around the world. This booklet on famine, that's the title of the booklet, will bring you up to date on population control, on the efforts of man with regard to the new varieties of grain, on harvesting the seas, and whether or not some of those alternative ideas of feeding the world's populations can really work. The ideas of developing new sources of protein from the oceans. The ideas of farming rainforests. Of producing synthetic-type foods. Will this stave off the final day of reckoning? All of this is discussed, too, in this booklet on famine. Is the answer eating less meat, as some say? Is that the answer to the world food crisis? This booklet on famine covers that. The religious and ideological hurdle is a part of the picture, and the booklet discusses that, too. Some of the shortcomings of agriculture, of technology, of the problems of the prodigious use of artificial pesticides, herbicides, of fertilizers and the like, the depletion of the soil, monoculture, and the vulnerability of the attack from insects and various crop blight as a direct result of monoculture. The new miracle strains of grain that were supposed to be a solution to the nations of Vietnam, the periphery of Southeast Asia, and the Philippines. and whether or not that really did work as people said it might. But the religious idea, too, of having to try to educate the hundreds of millions of people in the nations that are most afflicted most often by drought and famine, by flood and natural calamities such as India, Pakistan, and the like. What about telling those people to start eating some of the cattle because they're so protein deficient that is a major cause of malnutrition and disease? How do you overcome the religion which looks upon those cattle as being sacred? That's covered in this booklet on balancing the food population equation. The booklet is called Famine. That's the name of the booklet, just the word famine. It shows you about this idea of processing fish meal. There's a fish processing factory, for example, down in Valparaiso, as it's called in Chile, that manufactures fish meal for export. The idea of developing a kind of a food that looks like a gray gruel and kind of smells and tastes a little bit fishy, and whether or not people are going to really get turned on to that, and that's going to be our kind of food in the future. Write for this booklet, and you will see not only a historical documentation of some of the great famines of the past, but you will see some of the Bible warnings about famines and given an idea of exactly where we are in the race to feed starving mankind, and just exactly what Bible prophecies say about the specter of the black horse, of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the future, and famine. Write for that booklet called Famine. I wanted to tell you again about that booklet on famine, because here in Matthew 24, when Jesus talks about nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places, you need to know how every one of these major global events predicted by Jesus Christ in Matthew 24 are right at this moment leaping to life in the pages of your daily newspapers. Here we are with President Ford telling Congress in the near future up to 40 nations will possess atomic weapons. Here is one of the greatest and the most massive earthquakes in all of history, striking right out of the night with people asleep indoors, destroying, absolutely obliterating, a whole huge city. Perhaps up to 1 million or more people dead. And here are the words of Jesus Christ so many hundreds of years ago, that at the precise time when the potential for human destruction through warfare is with us, it would seem as if nature itself would be groaning and writhing in a death dance of total destruction. Famines and pestilences, and here you read of a strange, absolutely unheard-of disease striking people at a convention who, and they don't know whether it's from bacteria or a virus or food or water, they're just not sure. It defies description. Aching in the joints, diarrhea, tremendous fever, and many, many people struck down. At the same time, a violent storm, almost unprecedented rain, wipes out bridges and tumbles automobiles and homes and drowns people and buries them under mud in Colorado with a tremendous loss of life. Well, we can say that these disasters have always happened, and we would be, in part, correct. They have happened. They will no doubt continue to happen. Hapless humankind, oftentimes as a result of tidal wave, fire, windstorm, tornado, hurricane, flood, earthquake, will here and there in his millions be afflicted by what are called natural calamities. But has there always been a time where the potential for the extermination of humanity was with us on a day-to-day basis because of the production of incredibly powerful weapons? Now, when you answer that question honestly, and not try to come up with some answer about, oh, there have always been problems such as earthquakes and famines, you can be correct in saying that. But there has never been a time when the potential for the destruction of the human race because of the existence of nuclear weapons existed at the very same time as a unique outburst of natural calamities. Furthermore, since the Olivet prophecy of Matthew 24 focuses primarily on the Middle East, and since reports are coming out just within the last days that the most militarized region in the world today, proportionate to its size, is the Middle East, for at the same time, the concentration of much of the wealth of the world has gone flowing into the Middle East, where at the same time the dependency of the industrialized Western nations is almost focused entirely on the Middle East, where at the same time the possession of nuclear weapons is being revealed in the Middle East. And Jesus talks about Jerusalem, the area of Palestine, the Middle East, as being the focal point of that area of the world where prophecy will be fulfilled. The match which will ignite World War III will be struck, if it has not already been so, in the Middle East. Jesus said all of this, these earthquakes, famines, pestilences, disease epidemics, war, rumor of war, would be just the beginning. There would come a time, he said, when many will be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. That's happening now. Betrayal, hatred, unbridled, especially in the area of religion. You got to watch out for some of these religions. There are people who must make the devil absolutely envious at the purple, apoplectic, venomous rage they can experience over the religious tenets and practices of other people. There is nobody, it seems, who can hate any more venomously than people who get hooked on religion. Do you know that down through history, practically all the wars have been fought as a result of people trying to enforce their religious notions and beliefs on other people? There is nobody more egomaniacal, Machiavellian, and more absolutely disgustingly obnoxious than a papal kind of a figure who might pull himself up to his full egotistical height and claim to be the one great power who can tell you exactly how to think, how to live, when to sit and stand and ask his permission, what kind of a uniform to wear, what kind of a religion in which he ought to believe. And when you see down through history the various religious organizations study what it has done to nations, how it has actually interfered in politics, when you look at the fact that millions have perished because of the desire of other nations and nationalistic forms of religion to enforce their way of living and their culture, their language, their religion, their mysticism, their ideas on other human beings, you need to realize that religionists have slain most of the world's millions. It's either religion or anti-religion. In the case of Hitler and his pogroms against the Jews, it was doing away with the members of a religion, where race and religion are almost one. Many people can argue that. I won't argue it. But the point is that Hitler was trying to do away with the Jews. You know, even though most newspapers pay no attention to the religious aspects of the Middle East, those are the most important ones. Now, they do in the nation of Lebanon. But you almost never see the fact that unlike any other part of the world, perhaps, the area of the Middle East between the Israelis and the surrounding Arab neighbors is a tinderbox of religious hatred. There are religious hatreds within the various Arab countries. For example, Lebanon, even now being torn apart as a result of the Muslim-Christian forces. Other nations that have various different sects, various aspects of Christianity, such as Coptic and Maronite, as it's called, various, different so-called Christian. They call it Christian because I guess Christ figures in a religion one way or another. If it is the real Jesus, might be a good question for you to ask. But the same thing is true of some of the Muslim countries who can war against each other, who can hate each other, where tribalism, racism, and religion all intermingle to cause problems. But the headlines ought to talk about the religious aspects in the Middle East, too. Because it's not all just claims by the Arabs for return of territory. It's not always just political or military. The fact is that there are two of the world's great religions meeting head-to-head right in that area. And that basically, they simply just don't like one another. And that's a very kind and a very polite way to put it. If you look down through history, you will find that those things which have divided nations have been primarily religion, secondarily race, and thirdly, politics, nationalism, chauvinism, militarism, and the like. But where state worship, race, and all of that can intermingle, as in the case of Adolf Hitler, when you make a religion out of the worship of a state, and you make the state the extension of one's own desires and frustrations, and you begin to actually create a monstrous beast out of a kind of a state militaristic regime, which in fact is worshiped as if it were a religion. So that Hitler designed the idea of a super race, who had the right to push every other lesser race out of the way and to rule the world. And that's religion. Hitler made himself into a pseudo-god. Hitler was a false Christ. Hitler was trying to set up a false millennium. And so Hitler was going to usher in the kingdom of Hitler, which in his own demented, egotistical mind meant God, no doubt. Hitler kind of thought he was God. He was playing God. Now, actually, he was a little frustrated Austrian corporal that probably belonged back you know, hanging up wallpaper. But that just shows you the unbelievable, maniacal egalomania of some individuals. Hitler was that kind of an individual. You know, they said that Haile Selassie, in his last days in his palace, when he was under close house arrest, still allowed to have servants around him after the coup there that overthrew him from power, was, as his mind, I guess, was kind of going a little, but in his last days, he was still kind of snapping out orders about this and that to his servants. You know that the man, even though he was under house arrest, still, in his own mind, thought that he was the ruler of the nation, and kind of like a demented dictator, was going about the rooms of the palace in there, snapping out orders to servants, move this army here, move the navy over there, do this, do that, run about and get such and such a program going. And the poor demented guy, actually in his last days, thought that he was still in charge of the country. Unbelievable. But that's what happened. I suppose he was getting up there in age, and some of the things that happened were just beyond his ability to comprehend. Perhaps there were certain mental problems as a result of that. But be that as it may, the world has been filled with would-be despots, dictators, would-be false Christs who wanted to make a religion out of a state form of worship, of a military and political organization which would rise up to be everything that God claims he is, the protector and the provider of the people, the one great loyalty of the people, the one great organization which demanded the faith and the entire love, devotion, affection, loyalty, and attention of the people, the one which on the one hand taxed the people heavily, but in return gave the people everything. And so governments literally play at this business of being God. The things which divide governments are the very essence of government itself. Tribalism, color, group instinct, race, bigotry, prejudice, language, cultural, music, literature, all of the customs and ways of life, everything that makes a person what he is. If he says, I'm Scot, I'm British, I'm Welsh, I'm Irish, I'm Dutch, I'm American, German, French, Spanish. He is such because of language, because of nativity, background, because of all that he knows about his culture and his way of life. And so chauvinism, racism, nationalism, and pride enter in. And perhaps most importantly, religion. For even sometimes, race can be the same, nationalism the same, language the same, and religion can divide, as in the case of Northern Ireland. And so those age-old problems which still divide mankind are with us today, and now threatening nuclear bomb World War III. You need an understanding of the overview of prophecy to get a handle on where we are in world events today. And the only way to do it is to understand what Christ said about Bible prophecy, and to read Matthew 24, so that you really understand it. Write to this booklet on famine that shows you exactly what Jesus meant about impending famines around the world, and also this booklet on how to understand prophecy. How to understand Bible prophecy is free of charge, no price, and request the current number of the Plain Truth magazine with up-to-the-moment articles on these world conditions that show you the overview in the light of Bible prophecy. If you dial the toll-free number, 800-423-4444, we'll send it to you by return mail absolutely free of charge, 800-423-4444, or write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Tell us the call letters of your station, please. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.